Welcome back to another episode of the Damage Report. We're in 2019, and to give you an idea of the level of mental stability I'm entering the new year in, there's a fly in the studio, and I might lose it in the middle of the show because it keeps flying near my head. But regardless of flies, we have a new house. Did you know that? It's an exciting day in U.S. government because the distribution of power between the different branches has been fundamentally changed. We no longer have unified Republican control over government, and that is extremely consequential. And so we're going to be starting off the show with a bunch about that. Some good news, a little bit of bad news as well, but we have a packed show other than that too. We have two guests who are going to be joining us. One is going to be breaking down H.R. 1, so the big first piece of legislation that the Democrats are planning to put forward, a massive anti-corruption, new ethics piece of legislation that also has components of increased voter participation and all of that. Very important legislation. We're going to be talking about that. Then later on, Kara Buckley, who's the culture editor for the New York Times, is going to be joining the show for the first time. She previously wrote on a study showing that over the last few years, movies led by women actually earned more at the box office than movies led by men, which is certainly not what you think is going on out there based on the decisions that are made by major movie production houses. So we're going to be talking about that, some of the consequences for the next few years. Closing out the show with Meanwhile In, where we take a little jaunt around the world of news. In fact, the solar system of news this year. We're going to be doing all of that and more. But first, the House. The swearing in of not only the new speaker, but also the new House has happened. And we now have Democratic control of the House, which is no small thing. Speaking for myself personally, I've already moved on and I want more, but it is big. It is major. And it means that in all likelihood, 2019 is going to be the worst year of Donald Trump's life, which will be great for those of us who have been experiencing the last couple of years. But I want to start off on a good note, not just Schadenfreude. We have some good news. Let's bring up this first graphic showing some of the new members of Congress that are being sworn in. There you see Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, and Omar, others as well, showcasing not only that this is the most female House that we've ever had, but it's also racially diverse as well, which is awesome, diverse in terms of sexual orientation too. If we go to this next graphic, you're going to see, we just have to accept, like Ilhan Omar tweeted out, my father and I greeting friends, family, and supporters who traveled across the country to share this special moment with us. I mean, how amazing is that? And I saw she tweeted out a photo yesterday. It was her walking with her father through an airport, and she said, this is the same airport. Oh my God, I'm like getting a little bit choked up. That we walked through when we first came to this country, and I think 19 years later, her father was accompanying her to be sworn in as the first Somali American ever elected to the Congress. Like, how amazing is that? Other good stuff going on too. Just interesting historical note. Rashida Tlaib is going to be sworn in on Thomas Jefferson's Quran, which is both amazing historically and also will cause many right-wing heads to simply explode. There's going to be a House rule change that will allow Ilhan Omar to wear a veil in the House as well. So, big changes in terms of diversity, and we have a Congress that looks more like America, finally. Interesting historical note, too, though. I saw Ryan Strook on Twitter. He tweeted out some stats. So, did you know that back in 1989, of all of the people in the House, there were 16 Democratic women, there were 13 Republican women. So, that's 29 women in the House. Bear in mind, there are hundreds in the House back in 1989. So 16 Democrats, 13 Republicans. And, flash forward, was it 30 years? Big changes, actually. 89 Democrats. So a much higher number, still not representative, but much higher. You know how the Republicans are doing? 13. They have not gotten one additional raw woman member of their caucus in 30 years. And I know I saw these numbers were going around in New York Times and all of that, and they're trying to work it out. They're trying to, why is that? Why is it that more women aren't running and winning as Republicans? And I don't think it's as complicated as they think it is. I mean, first of all, if you're a woman, you're probably a little bit less likely to be a Republican in the first place. You also probably buy into quite a bit of the Republican rhetoric about the role of women in society, in the home, all of that. So you're probably less likely to run. If you're a Republican voter, you certainly seem less likely to vote for a woman. I mean, you could ask in polls, do you think it would be a good thing if we ever had a female president? And it seems like the sort of thing where how could you say no? And yet a significant chunk of Americans generally, to be fair, say no, but a higher percentage of Republicans say it. So can we really be that shocked that there's not that many Republican women in Congress? But anyway, good improvements for the Democrats, absolutely terrible for the Republicans. But what does this all mean in terms of what we'll actually get and what we won't get in the new year? Because it is good news, but it's not universally good news. So, you know, let's start off with the bad news. This is a damage report after all. So here are some of the things that do not change, even though we were successful in getting the House. If something happens with the Supreme Court and another spot opens up, this new Democratic House effectively doesn't change anything about that. It is likely that Donald Trump will still be able to nominate anyone he wants, you know, ideologically, in terms of their history of potentially assaulting people. He can nominate whoever he wants, and he's probably going to get that person. That doesn't change, unfortunately. In terms of our ability to actually pass legislation, effectively nothing has changed. Now, strategically, that does not mean that legislation shouldn't be put forward, that we shouldn't be pushing for, you know, big, bold responses to the problems that we face. But in terms of actually passing it, you still have a Republican Senate, you still have a Republican president. So we have to bear in mind that having one branch of government or one sub-branch of government is great. Having lots of them is far better. And so bear that in mind in the future. Like, as much as, so I want Bernie Sanders as president or another progressive as president. But I also understand that if along the way we don't do what is necessary to take control of the Senate and keep control of the House, it will be great to have him as president, but not quite as consequential as if he will actually be able to pass legislation. Taking control of the Supreme Court would also be good for that same reason. Now, there is good, though. There are good things that we can expect from this. So the ability of the Republicans to pass another round of absolutely massive tax cuts has been significantly curtailed. Now, I wouldn't put it past some of the Democrats to vote for some form of tax cuts, potentially, although there's going to be a lot of pressure on them not to do so. But the idea that they're going to massively drop the corporate tax rate again or the rates on the 1%, things like that, like they did last year, that seems far less likely now that we have this Democratic House majority. Huge cuts to Medicare and Social Security, which are not hypothetical, by the way. These are things that Paul Ryan was very much talking up throughout last year that they were planning to do in 2019 if they maintain their House majority. That is now out the door. That is not going to happen. Let's see, destroying the ACA. They tried back in 2017. They were defeated thanks to a couple of Republicans turning, in the Senate. That now is not going to happen. The idea that we're going to get rid of the ACA, you know, aside from the Supreme Court potentially destroying it, that's still possible. But in Congress, that is not going to happen. That is not a small thing either. And I will just say other legislation. Because honestly, as much as I pay attention to media, as much as I have now been in this career for, you know, 6 or 7 years or whatever, I can't necessarily predict what god-awful legislation they would have passed if they had maintained their control of the House. I mean, I wouldn't have predicted going into 2018 that they'd be caging babies, but they came up with that. So now, with the House controlled by the Democrats, we have a bulwark against all of those insane priorities that they had already made progress on previously and certainly would have pushed for more in the future. So that is good. But not everything is great. So while we have all these new House members being sworn in, we also have Nancy Pelosi, who is not the worst person who could be Speaker, certainly. But it frustrates me to a great degree that even questioning the possibility of having someone else was considered like saying Lord Voldemort out loud. Like, how can you possibly not support? Like, yes, she was the Speaker before. She's very experienced inside of the caucus. That's not the only things you want in a speaker necessarily. And I feel like we could have had a more robust discussion about that. And in terms of what she has actually done, in terms of setting her priorities now that she is going to be speaker again, I mean, we talked yesterday about PAYGO. That is not a good sign for how she actually plans to rule as head of the House once again. And I am frustrated that more haven't come forward to say that they're going to vote against that rules package. You in the audience, we put pressure on people yesterday, hoping that some would hear that and do the right thing. And as of right now, I believe on the record, we have the same two we had yesterday. That's AOC and Ro Khanna. We have others saying, you know, that they're still thinking about it, but not 18. Not 18 and not close to 18, unfortunately. And some people, like we talked about yesterday on the Young Turks, Representative Pramila Jayapal, the head of the Progressives in Congress, who's been on the show previously, she is now coming out and saying why she thinks that it will be okay if those rules go into effect. And look, I trust her on the issues. I trust her ideologically, but I do still question this. Now, look, we laid out why PAYGO is terrible on the show yesterday. But we are also, this is not a program that sort of barters in the simplistic. And you know, people who are both for it and against it have talked about it in ridiculously oversimplified terms. We don't do that here, but it is still bad. Even if it is not a barrier that cannot be overcome, it's still bad. Now, yes, exemptions have been carved out. Pramila Jayapal and others have been talking about that on Twitter. So in terms of Medicare for All, which by the way, hearings are in the process of being scheduled for, that is no small thing too, that right off the bat, we're getting into discussion of one of the biggest policy priorities. That is huge. And apparently exemptions have been created for that and other left positions. So that is good, assuming that their word is actually worth something in House leadership, and that will remain to be seen. We'll be watching them, obviously. But it shouldn't be there to begin with. Some of the other rules changes are fine. I'm totally in favor of them. There's no reason that PAYGO needs to be one of them. Now, there are added wrinkles, just really fast. So even if it wasn't part of the House rules, it is still law. That is true. So defeating it in the House doesn't mean that we would not have to defeat it in terms of law. And Pramila Jayapal is saying that she and others are going to put forward legislation to get rid of it. We will see if that is able to pass. I don't understand why the Republicans in the Senate would support it. So likely we will be in as bad of a situation later on as we are now in terms of that. And yes, a House majority can vote to overrule PAYGO for particular pieces of legislation, which hopefully will provide an out. And I guess objectively, if you can't get a majority to vote for overruling it, you probably can't get a majority to vote for it in the first place. These are all things that we're going to be on the lookout for. But going into the new year with this as one of the major rules changes is not a good sign. And so as much as I would like to be able to say, hey, new house, new year, new reality, no, our job continues, the struggle continues, regardless of which side of the camera that you're on, regardless of whether you're in the House or you're trying to push them to do the right thing. Now, that said, we are going to take a break. When we come back, guests are going to be joining us. Other legislative priorities, we're going to be breaking down how that's going to shake out after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
So we've got a new house. They're being sworn in. But what are they going to do with their new power? Joining us to help break it down, Rio Tazewell, Government by the People campaign manager. Rio, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Yeah, great to be here.
Very glad to have you here to help break down the legislative priorities of this new House majority. So we, about a month and a half ago, got an idea without specifics, really, of what H.R. 1 is going to include. Could you break down some of the major components of it?
Sure. So it's a very broad pro-democracy reform package that includes some really important pillars for creating a better and more transparent and equitable democracy, including campaign finance reform, regulating the influence of big money in politics, protecting and expanding the right to vote, as well as ethics and anti-corruption reforms to ensure that our elected officials are behaving ethically while in office and afterwards.
So I want to break down basically all of the different components that you just mentioned. But in terms of priorities, what the Congress does as its first act is obviously symbolically quite important. I know the previous House, the Republican House, had sort of tax changes as their first Act, which I think is perfectly symbolic. Why do you think that the Democrats decided to start off with voting rights, anti-corruption, that sort of thing, as opposed to one of their other legislative priorities?
Well, I think the Democratic Party is very aware of the fact that people of all political stripes are very frustrated and frankly appalled by what we're witnessing now from this administration, but also going further back. I mean, it's no surprise that many people are very disillusioned with government and feel that our elected representatives aren't always serving their constituents' interests and are very much beholden to wealthy and powerful interests, corporate interests, et cetera. And that, you know, these reforms are popular, and indeed they are. There's a polling that shows that there's an overwhelming amount of people across the country that want to see this type of thing happen. And honestly, there's been Democrats pushing for these types of reforms for a long time now. It has yet to really rise to the top in terms of priorities, just given the fact that there's so many competing interests, you know, healthcare, tax reform, et cetera. But now we're at a point in American history where the need for anti-corruption reforms and pro-democracy reforms is so crystal clear, particularly given the atrocious things that we're witnessing from the Trump administration, that it's really risen to the top to get top billing. So it's literally H.R. 1, the first piece of legislation introduced in the House.
Okay, so why don't we dive into it? I mean, one of the priorities here at TYT is campaign finance reform. So what are the components having to do with that in the bill, and how significant of reforms are these?
So the campaign finance piece is one of the most important parts of the bill. It's going to include a system of public financing of elections so that average individual people that don't have a network of wealthy people to collect large checks from can effectively fundraise and mount a competitive campaign. So it'll be a dollar for dollar match. There's a ratio. The final language is going to get worked out in committee over the next few weeks, but it'll basically be modeled after the Government by the People Act, which Congressman Sarbanes has been championing for a while now. And it's going to follow a lot, very much along the lines of other public financing programs which exist in cities already. So that'll allow people to really basically raise money from their communities and have the government match it at a ratio depending on the race, depending on the state, et cetera, so that they can compete with candidates that do take special interest money in large amounts.
So in terms of elections, I know that there are components having to do with shoring up the Voting Rights Act, which obviously was dealt a pretty big blow a few years back, and some changes in terms of registration. What are some of the standouts in those areas?
So one of the most important pieces in terms of voting rights is that it'll reinstate the Voting Rights Act that was essentially repealed in 2013 with a Supreme Court decision, which basically allowed for states that had been basically overseen to basically make new laws regarding voting rights. And it has allowed for essentially discrimination, particularly against people of color. I believe it's 10 states that were previously held to a higher standard because of a history of discrimination in 2013. Since 2013, they've been able to basically enact these new voter ID laws and other forms of voter suppression. And this bill will basically reinstate those oversight protocols that had been established previously with the Voting Rights Act. But there's other components that are probably going to get worked in to modernize the voting process and basically make it easier for people to participate at the ballot box.
Has there been any debate about a national voter holiday or anything like that?
There certainly is people suggesting that, and it could make its way in. The bill is going to go through committee. It's going to get marked up, and any number of amendments could be added. And you know, I think that's a great idea. There's a lot of great ideas in terms of what can be done to make voting more accessible and, frankly, just get more people doing it, given that, you know, turnout is really a real problem in this country. And we could probably really address that by just making it easier for people to vote. So I think an election day holiday is one of many great ideas that can further that aim.
I agree. So moving on to those who are already in office, as you alluded to, people look at a lot of these elected politicians and they see them as corrupt and beholden to their donors and all of that. In terms of ethics reforms, I know that that's another big part of this bill. How significant are the changes in terms of what ability these representatives are already in office in terms of what they can get up to?
So the ethics piece is quite significant, and there's a lot of different moving pieces. you know, naturally. But one of the main parts is that people in office will have to divest from companies or industries where they have oversight. And if they're able to influence the rules on an industry that they're, you know, invested in, then that's a clear conflict of interest. And this bill will address that. Another thing that it's going to tackle is the revolving door. Here in Washington and really state capitals all across the country, we have this phenomenon where people serve in elected office for a period of time and then go and become a full-time lobbyist. And they're basically able to just cash in on their connections. And that's really a big part of why special interests and corporate interests are able to get so much of what they want, because they hire retired elected officials to come and work for their offices and basically use their networks to advance their interests on Capitol Hill and in state capitals. So the ethics provision, the anti-corruption provision of H.R. 1 is also going to address that pervasive problem of the revolving door.
So one final question. Obviously things can change, there could be amendments, but there is going to be a requirement that presidents or presidential candidates reveal tax returns as a component of this as well.
Yes, that will also be a provision that's currently in the bill, and you know, we'll see if it makes it into the final version. But clearly, that has become a major issue with this particular administration and this president. You know, that hasn't been an issue in the past, but it, clearly it is at this point. And that alone would give us a huge amount of transparency in terms of the level of corruption that we're witnessing with this administration.
And hopefully can do something to rebuild the Americans' trust in their elected officials.
Indeed.
Rio Tazewell, thank you so much for joining us and helping break down the bill. There's obviously a lot of components, but I think you explained it very well. So thank you. Rio Tazewell, People for the American Way.
Thanks.
Okay, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, update on Bernie Sanders, big story in the New York Times recently. I'm going to respond to that. And then a sheriff has been serving, as we alluded to on yesterday's show, serving rotten food to their inmates to pocket hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars after this. Welcome back to the show, everyone. Lots to get into. Let's jump right into it. I want to start with a big story about Bernie Sanders that came out in the New York Times just recently, a couple of days ago. That is a big story, but not necessarily for the exact reasons that a lot of the news coverage of it implies. So if you didn't see it, the New York Times published a story on Wednesday afternoon detailing stories of mistreatment of women and gender pay disparity from former Sanders staffers. Some women who worked for the Vermont Senator said their complaints about sexual harassment were ignored or brushed aside, or that they were, quote, taken aback to see how much less female staffers made in comparison to their male counterparts. And specifically, there were cases where in seemingly the same job, women were being paid thousands of dollars less. So that is certainly significant. Bernie Sanders is facing questions about that. He was on Anderson Cooper. Here is his response to questions about this story.
When our campaign grew from, I think we started with three or four paid employees, and over a period of a few months, as the campaign exploded, we went up to, I think, 1,200 employees. And I am not going to sit here and tell you that we did everything right in terms of human resources, in terms of addressing the needs that I'm hearing from now, that women felt disrespected, that there was sexual harassment, which was not dealt with as effectively as possible. What I will tell you is that when I ran for re-election in 2018 in Vermont, we put forward the strongest set of principles in terms of mandatory training, in terms of women, if they felt harassed, having an independent firm that they can go to. And I think that's kind of, you know, the gold standard for what we should be doing. So I certainly apologize to any woman who felt that she was not treated appropriately. And of course, if I run, we will do better next time.
So there you have his response. Obviously, there was more to it. Feel free to look that up. But I wanted to talk a little bit about the coverage of the story. There's nothing wrong with the story. The story has, they have sources inside of what had been Bernie Sanders' campaign saying that they wanted to convene to meet and figure out if Bernie Sanders does run again, what do they need to change to make sure that nothing like that happens? Now, that does not imply that they did not already make many changes. Sanders alluded to some of them in that video, but they wanted to make sure that nothing like that happened again. So, New York Times doing a fine job in reporting on that. Some of the other news coverage about it, though, I would say has a little bit more of a political angle. That is being talked about not because of the content of the story, but because of what it might achieve if it becomes a big story. So let's bring up a section of an article from Vox. So Vox is a source that I generally like. There in their article on it, they're saying it's not clear how much of a problem this might be if Sanders does run in 2020, implying that there's a possibility that the issues that they experienced in 2016, that they have spent time addressing both during that campaign and since, and apparently are taking so seriously that in advance of another run, they want to meet with all of those senior advisors to make sure that it doesn't happen again, could theoretically sink his presidency. That is what I take out of that section of this Fox article, which seems a little bit divorced from the original reporting. So I want to talk about this briefly. One thing that this story actually is, and three that it is not. So first of all, what it is. It is a big deal. It is a big deal that women were either sexually harassed or there's some idea that there might have been sexual violence as well. I haven't seen any specifics about that, but there's a possibility that that happened as well during the campaign in this staff. Now, staff is really big, obviously, but any sexual harassment, sexual violence, let alone pay disparities, people feeling disrespected, anything like that is a gigantic problem. But what this is not is just a problem with Bernie Sanders' campaign. This is a problem with American politics and political campaigns. It's a problem with America generally. Pay disparity is not a thing that came up for the first time in the Sanders campaign. It is endemic throughout American society. In virtually every career field, that is a significant problem that needs to be addressed. And I would say one politician that talks constantly at his rallies about addressing that is Bernie Sanders. Now, he needs to make sure that even at the lowest levels of his campaign, even though he has no direct oversight over that, that it's not happening there as well. But the idea that this is a guy who doesn't care about that when he constantly talks about the need to end it federally, that seems a little bit bizarre, I would say. What this is also not is a story specifically about Bernie Sanders. Now, no one is saying that Bernie Sanders sexually harassed anyone, sexually assaulted anyone, that he specifically asked for someone to be paid less. Now, that does not make it not an issue, but it is an issue of his staff, something that they need to take seriously and apparently both did once it was reported and have since then. Whether he runs again, he's saying that he has already taken the lessons from that and has integrated that into his Senate office and employees and all of that as well in a way that seems exactly how politicians should deal with this. And so this is a big issue outside of just Bernie Sanders, that some in the media are going to make seem like this is just an issue of Bernie Sanders. And we cannot divorce it from the context of some of the arguments against Bernie Sanders back in 2016. One of the chief arguments that some would like to make against Bernie Sanders and against his supporters has nothing to do with policy whatsoever. It is difficult to argue against policies that are popular, so I understand they have a big obstacle to overcome there. But that it is Bernie Sanders only appeals to a couple of very specific types of people. He appeals to men. And he appeals to white people. And that is an argument that popped up very early on in his presidential run, back when he was still polling very poorly. Now, where did that argument come from? Did it come from people writing at these outlets going to Bernie rallies and doing counts of the people who appear there? No, of course not. And I've been to many of his rallies, and I understand how diverse they are in terms of gender, in terms of race, and all of that. Did it come from looking at the polling of the types of people that actually like Bernie Sanders? It doesn't come from there either. As we talked, we broke it down a couple of weeks ago, Bernie Sanders' approval rating amongst women is significantly higher than his approval rating amongst men. His approval rating amongst African Americans is significantly higher than it is amongst white Americans. So it is divorced from the actual numbers, the things that we can look at, the things that we can verify. But it does need to be maintained. Because there are some people who are invested in the idea that when he runs again, if he runs again, because he probably will run again, it is still going to be very hard to argue against his policies, increasingly so, since they're more popular than they were back in 2016. So something else needs to come up, and this might well be it, if they can get enough people in the media to play along. So at the same time that this is not a story about Bernie Sanders being some sort of misogynist, that the headlines would lead you to believe it is still a big problem that he needs to and apparently has been dealing with. We need to make sure that that continues into his next presidential run if it does happen, while not advancing narratives designed not to better the status of women working in the lower levels of Bernie Sanders' campaign, but to attack Bernie Sanders specifically. So it's a little bit complex. I apologize for that. But that is what we need to do and bear in mind as we go forward. Okay, we are going to take a break. We come back. Big study on movies. What movies actually make more money at the box office? The movie companies seem to think one type does. Turns out not so much after this. Is Hollywood unnecessarily shooting itself in the foot by rejecting this new crop of female-led movies? Joining us to help break it down, Kara Buckley, culture reporter for the New York Times. Kara, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm so excited to talk about this topic with you. So I saw you reporting for the New York Times on this topic, a study that was done looking over the course of a couple of different years about movies led by female actresses and by male actors and comparing their box office take. What did they find?
Well, they basically, for this study, they looked at the top 100 films for each year and broke down their earnings based on are the films led by men, are the films led by women. And they found out at each budget level, be it below $10 million, up to $30 million, $50, $50 to $100, $100 million plus, at all budget levels, the films led by women out-earned the films led by men. I mean, keep in mind that there were way more films led by men than women in those categories. But at each level, the average earnings that the films took in and the median earnings, which is the numerical center of the earnings, across the board, the women-led films out-earned the male-led films.
And not to get too into the weeds, but I was looking at, in some ways, it seemed like the study was kind of working against its eventual conclusion because movies like The Force Awakens were classified as male-led films, even though they were obviously led by an actress, despite the social media campaigns against her. She was the face of the movie, and it made a tremendous amount of money. So it sounds like the conclusion should actually be stronger than it is.
It could be. I mean, it just depends on who gets top billing in the film. You know, I mean, and it works both ways. So in the example of both of those Star Wars films that you mentioned, the leads were Mark Hamill in one, Harrison Ford in the other. Daisy Ridley had a secondary or tertiary billing. You know, they have to use some sort of statistical, they have to have, you know, a statistical standard. And for this, they just used in a studio system database, who is the first billing. And so in Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which was a top earner, Megan Fox received top billing. So, you know, it could work both ways.
I didn't see that one. I imagine the Turtles were a big part of it, though.
One would imagine. And in Trolls, Anna Kendrick. So, you know, I mean, they have to use some statistically sound, you know, they can't bend the rules just because they don't agree with who the studio gave top billing to. Yeah. But regardless, you know, the women-led films just simply out-earned the male-led films, even though they remain a minority compared to the ones led by dudes.
So let's get into why this is significant. So the conventional wisdom at least has been, and probably is, that movies that are led by women are going to make less money. And so less of them are made, and less money is put into the ones that are made. And certainly behind the camera, I mean, there's less female directors. People believe that a female director can't make a movie that's going to make a lot of money. Even though there have been these massive movies, especially over the past few years, is there any evidence that Hollywood is sort of getting it, at least a little?
You know, there's evidence that Hollywood is expressing concern about it more. But I just did a story that came out today about another study that found last year there were 8% fewer female directors leading the top films, directing the top films from 2018 compared to the previous year. So it suggests that, I don't know if things are changing, awareness around it is changing, but I think there has to be a real effort, like a full-on effort by the studios to change it. One of the reasons the study happened, it was, you know, created, the study was done in concert with Time's Up, which is, of course, the women-led movement out of Hollywood, fighting sexual discrimination across the workplace. And they are really trying to say, well, if we can't appeal to your moral, any moral imperative of you should make this, here's the bottom line. I don't know if it is changing. I mean, I think there are huge structural impediments. One of the things that someone involved in the study at Creative Artist Agency said was, you basically, there's a real hunger for fresh storylines. And, you know, this shouldn't be a surprise to us. But these films are planned years and years in advance. Yeah. And so it will take a while to see whether the proof is in the pudding. I think, you know, Wonder Woman was a game changer. Films like Girls Trip was a game changer. How much the game has changed, it doesn't really look good right now to me, even though that the numbers are there. Mm-hmm.
So one of your more, I believe it's your most recent piece, was on Black Panther and the possibility that the performance of Black Panther shows that minority-driven films can do better overseas than the stereotype had previously been. Previously seen, I think for last year, although Infinity War made more money domestically than Black Panther, Black Panther made far more money overseas. And so I wonder, the lack of resources that have been put into releasing movies overseas that are either directed or led by African-Americans, other minorities, mm-hmm. I wonder if that might change as well. Although, as you allude to, perhaps it will take some time.
Right. And I mean, the interesting thing I found when reporting out that story, you know, films like Black Panther, Crazy Rich Asians last year, they did amazing. Films like, you know, in earlier years, Get Out, and even a tiny film like Moonlight, which won the Best Picture Oscar, of course, after that snafu, did exceedingly well, is that they're seen as more of a risk inherently. And what people who are in the business are saying is it's not more of a risk. It's problematic that it's seen as a risk. Mm-hmm. And for, you know, in order for that to change, really the structure of who's running the studios, who are in the key decision-making roles, what do those people look like, who are they talking to, that really has to change. There's hope that it will change, but this story is kind of an evergreen story. Every time there's a big movie fronted by people of color, the question's posed, will Hollywood finally get away with the myth that quote unquote black films or films led by people of color don't travel? The New York Times wrote about this in 2007. And while it feels like it really should change, it remains to be seen whether it will. That said, some studios are, you know, pushing the envelope. Disney was involved in Black Panther. Disney did Moana. You know, they've really decided to step up and diversify the stories that they're telling, and they seem to be reaping the benefits. There's also, there really is a hunger for films, you know, that aren't from the same perspective. And as I think this study about women-led films earning more than male-led films shows, you know, there's this thirst, there's the economic reason to do it. What really needs to be done, and what I believe is being done somewhere, is a study of how exactly films led by people of color do perform abroad, because we compare it to films by white people, mm-hmm. as by and starring white people. We don't have those figures yet. But if the films are being promoted less, you know, because of beliefs that they won't perform well, you know, the industry arguably is shooting themselves in the foot, because there are suggestions that films do great, you know, when they are good films. Films like Fast and the Furious is one of the most successful franchises, and it has a very diverse lineup in front of the camera.
Certainly. I wish we had more time, especially I wanted to get into TV. Perhaps we can talk again sometime in the future on that. But anyway, I want to thank you for your work. A fascinating topic, and thank you for joining us on the Damage Report, Kara.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to take one more break. When we come back, we're going to take a little tour around the planet, around the solar system, news from all over the place after this. Here in America, we're all caught up with this new house thing, but there's a whole world of news going on, and that is why the Damage Report has Meanwhile In. Meanwhile, in the UK, they're considering instituting a pudding tax. I don't know if they're actually going to call it that. I just like the idea. It's so British. But basically, there is a huge issue with sugar consumption in the UK, as there is in pretty much all the places that Western food has ended up, unfortunately. Did you know that by the age of 10, the average child has exceeded the recommended level of sugar intake for an 18-year-old in the UK? So they're ahead of the curve there in Britain. And the idea is that drinks with more than 8 grams of sugar per 100 milliliters face a tax rate equivalent to 24p per liter. So you can go on the internet to convert that if you want. But basically, there's a tax right now on some types of fizzy drinks. But they want to expand that because there's a lot of things that kids consume that have this aura or mystique of being healthy, but actually include a lot of sugar. So fruit juices and things like that. And then obviously we have a larger societal problem where everything from bread to ketchup to, you know, canned soup all has added sugar as well. And when you add it all up, these kids are looking at theoretically significant health problems later on in their life. And so in the same way that in different parts of the US, we're considering different taxes on, you know, sodas and things like that, including information about added sugars on labels, Britain is also apparently considering taking it slightly more seriously in the future. And while that's going on, meanwhile in... There's no reason for that to be a video of me. But anyway, meanwhile in Norway, they have set a world record for electric car sales, which is incredibly exciting from my point of view. The independent Norwegian Road Federation announced on Wednesday that 31.2% of all car sales in 2018 were electric, an increase from 20.8% just in 2017 and 5.5% in 2013, which is amazing of a pickup. In just a few years, like, they're very slowly being adopted in increasing numbers in America, but in Norway, significantly faster acceptance for a couple of different reasons. So sales of gasoline and diesel cars apparently plummeted in conjunction with new benefits that Norway set up for electric car owners, like tax-exempt status, free parking, and charging stations. You do get that in some places in America. If you were lucky enough to live in a lot of major cities, then you might have access to like the carpool lane. That's a thing. Or you might have electric car parking spots with chargers in things like malls at the beach. That's all stuff we have in LA. Unfortunately, in large parts of the country, there aren't benefits like that. Let alone benefits, there aren't charging stations, which is a significant problem. So a country like Norway, which has more centralized population areas, a far larger total amount of area and far less people, can theoretically spool that sort of thing up faster. But we can learn something from this. We should not be dialing back our electric tax benefits the way that we are. I just saw that GM and Tesla have now reached their cap on sort of the benefit of how many cars they can sell and get those tax incentives for their customers. We need to expand that, obviously, not only so that we can hopefully catch up to Norway, so that we don't fall further behind. This record that was set by Norway is great. I would love to see the U.S. exceed it at some point in the near future. We certainly need that. Meanwhile, in Brett is a madman. Meanwhile, in the farthest reaches of our solar system, NASA has released photos of literally the farthest away object we have ever explored. They did that while buzzing by it with a probe that was launched back in 2006. What you're seeing there are photos of Ultima Thule, which is 4 billion miles away from the sun, which is so far that I honestly don't even know what that means at that point. It's really, really far. And hey, it looks like a snowman, which is sort of ridiculous, but apparently there are a good number of bodies out there that look sort of like this. NASA released a bunch of technical speak about what it means. I don't really understand much of it, but I am amazed either way. I will say this, Ultima Thule consists of two almost spherical lobes, one with about 3 times the volume of the other, which is a little bit hard to tell from the photo, honestly. But they named it based on the fact that it was these two different bulbs. In terms of what NASA can learn from this that can then be applied to our everyday lives, I have no idea. But it is amazing that we launched something just 12 years ago, and it is already almost 4 billion miles away from the sun. That is just incredible. Just purely for scientific reasons. This is not one of those things where it's really applicable, but I do like it as a nerd. As a fan of Star Trek and Star Wars, I want to see more of this in the future. So good job, NASA. You've done good. So meanwhile in Brazil, Jair Bolsonaro, their new president, who we've talked a lot about on this program quite a bit, took a major step towards undermining the rights of indigenous people in some of the rural areas of Brazil, while also setting the stage for increased economic benefit to them, I guess, but certainly environmental loss, both for Brazil and for the rest of the country. Let me get this fly away from me. The incoming government on Tuesday transferred responsibility for certifying indigenous territories as protected lands to the Ministry of Agriculture. The ministry has traditionally championed the interest of industries that want greater access to protected lands. So you have these big areas, a lot of them heavily forested, jungle, all that. And you have indigenous communities there, which they made the mistake of hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of years ago settling in an area that someone would want to strip mine later on, either to sell the lumber or to graze cattle or whatever. They want those resources. And up until recently, thankfully, there had been concern on the part of the government that these people and their traditional ways of life, just their ability to exist there at all, should not be set on fire so that someone could sell hamburgers. But unfortunately, Jair Bolsonaro, who is a homophobic, racist, fascist piece of trash, is now in office. He has the power. And so God only knows what is going to happen to those communities. And I will say his first comment about this change does not make me feel better. He said less than 1 million people live in those places isolated from the real Brazil. They are explored and manipulated by nonprofits. Okay, that is scary stuff. They are real Brazilians as well and deserve protection too. So that's the news from around the country, around the world, around the solar system. Thank you for watching. We'll see you tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.